Turn your Bibles, if you would, to Genesis chapter 41. And as you're turning there, I just would kind of throw out the statement that we need to be careful what we ask for sometimes. I mean, Joseph may have prayed to be delivered from his brothers when they were mistreating him and had even thrown him into that pit. And yet the Lord did deliver him from his brothers, not in the way that Joseph would have imagined, and certainly not one that he would have chosen. But then as he found himself a slave down in Egypt, he served Potiphar with all that was within him, and then Mrs. Potiphar started making the moves on him. And I'm sure he prayed many times that God would set him free from that situation, that he would deliver him from that thing. And God did. Not the way he would have chosen, I'm sure. Certainly not one of the things that he would have imagined would be known as deliverance, but God did. And oftentimes in our lives, when we go through situations, we find ourselves kind of, maybe not to that degree as Joseph, but in the same way we're thinking, why God, why? And I believe that someday when we stand before him and we see the vastness of his wisdom and how at every moment he is holding every electron in this entire universe together just because he wills them to be so, and how he orchestrates everything to work together according to his divine will, we're going to be blown away at the way he cared for us. Now, as far as our text goes in Genesis, my thoughts are that, in my view, the first 40 chapters that we've already covered of Genesis have just been an introduction. And these last 10 chapters are going to be the real subject of the book, we see the stage having been set for tonight will be the beginning of the story of redemption. And we ended up last week with Joseph interpreting the dreams of his two fellow inmates. There was the butler who he interpreted his dream that within 3 days he would be lifted up and he would be returned back to the service of Pharaoh. That happened exactly as Joseph had determined through the interpretation of the dream. As far as the baker goes, he believed that instead of his head being lifted up, it was going to be lifted off. It happened that way as well. Joseph said to the butler, when you are restored, when you stand before Pharaoh, the last verse of chapter 40 says, he says, don't forget me. Remember me to Pharaoh and tell him that I'm an innocent man. And it says in verse 23 of chapter 40, yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Remember, in the Bible, the chapter and verse divisions are man-made. When Moses was dictating or writing out the book of Genesis, there wasn't a chapter division here. And it says that chief butler didn't remember Joseph, but forgot him. Then, he says, it came to pass that at the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh had a dream. Behold, he stood by the river. Now, it wasn't just 2 years. You know, Moses could have said it came to pass after 2 years, but he says after 2 full years. I think we can maybe underline the word full there, because it came at the tail end. By the time we are done with tonight's lesson, it will have been 14 years since his brothers had sold him into slavery. And he had had 7 years serving Potiphar and being his chief steward, and 7 years of imprisonment, which I think will factor into the interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams here. But it was 720 days, 17,280 minutes or hours, and over 1 million minutes. And every minute that passed, Joseph was thinking, maybe this is the day, maybe this is the time that the butler is going to tell Pharaoh and Pharaoh is going to call for me. And yet each day, each hour, each minute ended in disappointment. But, as it says in verse 1, it came to pass. And suddenly there came up out of the river, this is Pharaoh's dream, it came up out of the river 7 cows, fine looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. You know, every one of them was a Kobe beef ribeye. I mean, they were just as good as cows can get. But then behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. I mean, they were 99.9% fat-free. You know, you pay $2 extra for this at Walmart nowadays, but back then they wanted the Kobe beef. And it says that the ugly and gaunt cows ate up all the fine looking ones and the fat cows. And so Pharaoh awoke. And he slept and then dreamed a second time. You know, his first dream, waking up, and you go, whoa, what was that all about? But then he falls back to sleep, and suddenly seven heads of grain come up on one stalk, plump and good. And behold, seven thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the seven thin heads devoured the seven plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed, it was a dream. And so, you know, he's probably thinking, boy, I'm glad that was just a dream. But it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. You know, he woke up. We've all had dreams like that where you wake up in the middle of it. Maybe sometimes you wake up in a cold sweat, or you wake up with a start and you just feel, I mean, it takes a while for you to realize that it wasn't real. It was a dream. And then even after you've kind of settled down from that, you're still unsettled from the dream. But then pretty soon it kind of wears off and you go back to sleep and get about your day's business. That's how it started off with Pharaoh. But as the day wore on, it troubled him even more. So he calls all of his wise guys together. And the word magicians, is in the Hebrew, it's related to the word for stylus, because these were the guys that wrote the occultic books of Egyptian religion, you know, the Book of the Dead kind of guys. And so they used a stylus to write that, and that's where the word in Hebrew for magician comes from. And it says, the chief butler spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day, which in Hebrew, the literal translation is, oops, boy, do I have egg on my face. You know, after all of these 2 full years, 720 days, and he remembers it. The word translated, where he says, I remember my faults, the Hebrew word is usually translated sin. I remember my sins today. The NIV is a little shallow here where it says, I remember my shortcomings. That's probably not quite accurate. You know, Joseph, I'm sure, had another name for it. And it says, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody, this is the butler continuing his oops. He says, he put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker. We each had a dream one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. And now there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. Each man interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. And he restored me to my office, and he hanged him. In other words, Joseph interpreted my dream, and it was good. I got restored. But we interpreted the baker's dream, not so good. And so then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon. And he shaved and changed his clothing and came to Pharaoh. Now, you know, if you're familiar with the Hebrew culture, they're not real big on shaving. And that's fine. That's cool. But, you know, he'd been in prison for 14 years. I mean, there hadn't been any kind of grooming going on. You know, he probably had the dread thing and all of this going on with him. And the Egyptians, they're kind of like the opposite of that. I mean, every Egyptian wanted to look like Yul Brynner. You know, except that he had too bushy of eyebrows. They would even shave their eyebrows and then paint them on with mascara, with eyeshadow. They would remove every hair on their bodies. That was considered to be very masculine and attractive. And so when they brought Joseph out of prison, they took one look at him and says, we got some work to do before we can take you to Pharaoh. And here was the lowest slave on earth standing before the greatest monarch in the world. Quite a scene. But it's interesting. We know Joseph's name, but we never hear Pharaoh's. You know, here's Joseph, the lowest slave in the entire world, and yet we know his name, and yet we don't know Pharaoh's. We name our children Joseph. We name our dogs Pharaoh. So quite a contrast. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, verse 15, I have had a dream, and there's no one to interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, it's not in me. You know, I don't have anything of my own. But he says, God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. You know, he could have said, oh, your pharaohship, I've been framed. You know, I don't deserve to be where I'm at. I've been here all these years. I was libeled and framed and slandered and all of that. I'm an innocent man. He could have said all that, but he didn't. Instead, he gave the glory to God. Instead of complaining, he just said, you know what? God will take care of it. You know, people oftentimes come to me and they'll say, well, no. Sometimes people come to me and they'll say to me after a Bible study, they'll say, well, okay, it happened one time. Somebody came to me after a Bible study, and they said, man, that was a great Bible study. And I just said, I looked to them with all the humility I could muster and say, oh, it was the Lord. And oftentimes we'll do that, won't we? I mean, I understand. I mean, we do realize, even when our pride gets in the way, we still realize that it's God. And to him be the glory. I don't think that's what Joseph was doing here, though. When he said it belongs to the Lord, he meant it with all his heart. And it says in verse 17 that Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, so he's going to explain it to him here, and he says, I stood on the bank of the river, and suddenly seven cows came up from the river, looking fine and fat, and they fed in the meadow, and then behold, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt. The word ugly here is translated by two Hebrew words. There's two Hebrew words that are translated by this one word ugly, and they mean evil and appearance. Okay? So they weren't just simply ugly. They were evil looking ugly. And such ugliness, he goes on to say, I have never seen in all the land of Egypt. I mean, they put the ugh in ugly. He's saying, and so the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows. And when they had eaten them up, no one would have known they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as in the beginning. They didn't get any better looking after the big meal. And so I awoke. And also I saw in my dream, and suddenly seven heads came up on one stalk, full and good. But then behold, seven heads, withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind. You know, the east wind would be that which blew off of Saudi Arabia, off of the Arabian Desert. East wind sprang up after them, and the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. And so I told this to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. And so Joseph said to Pharaoh, he replies to him, the dreams that Pharaoh had are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. He says the seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. In other words, the interpretation of these two dreams are going to be the same. They're both God's saying it to you twice so that make sure you understand it. The seven good cows are 7 years and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. The seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after him, are 7 years. And the seven empty heads, blighted by the east wind, are 7 years of famine. So this is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. And so he says, not only am I, and you got to understand, this would be, I mean, Joseph, you didn't walk into Pharaoh's court, even if you had been summoned, even if he had called you, you didn't walk into Pharaoh's court and try to tell him what to do. You know, that was just an unknown thing. And he says to him, he says, this is what God's going to do, and so I'll tell you what you can do about that. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. The word severe here is the Hebrew word for heavy. It's going to be very weighty. It's the root of it is the word that comes from God's glory, the kabod. This is from the same word, and it just means something that's very weighty, something, you know, like in my generation, we go, oh, heavy, man. That's the word, okay? That's the idea here. And it's very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So he explains to Pharaoh, you know, in God's economy, a thing is established on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He doesn't just say it once to you because you just think, oh, it must have been pizza. You know, I ate pepperoni pizza last night before I went to bed. Bad idea. But he repeated the dream to you. He gave it to you twice so that you would understand that it was from God and this was for reals. And so now, therefore, verse 33, and this is where he's really stepping out of the comfort zone, I think. I mean, this is the anointing has come upon him here as he gets some boldness that would not normally be. This is the same boldness that Moses had when he stood before Pharaoh. He said, "Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt." You know, he wasn't asked for his opinion; he was asked for an interpretation. But Joe's taking it to the next step, and he's giving him advice on how to handle it. And let Pharaoh do this, and then let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. You know, the typical tax rate in that day was 10%. You know, there was 10% of all the products, the produce, the crops and the herds would be given to the government, be given to Pharaoh. And he's saying, we're just going to double it. We're going to make it 20%, but it's going to be such a time of plenty that the people won't even mind. They won't even notice the increase in the taxes because they'll be so bountiful. And then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh and let them keep food in the cities. They actually set up grain cities. They built cities just to receive all this stuff. And they set it up as storage locales. And then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. Anybody ever been to Egypt? Anybody ever seen a picture of Egypt? Egypt is dry. I mean, the nation of Egypt gets an average of 1 inch of rainfall a year. It's a dry place. And yet they've got this river that goes right through the middle of it called the Nile. And it was like this, it was believed to be the bloodstream of Osiris because that Nile was the Egyptians' provider. The Nile gave them everything that they needed for life. And it was faithful, the Nile. Because it wasn't dependent upon the rains that would happen in the land of Egypt, because it didn't rain in the land of Egypt. In fact, it wasn't until the 20th century that geologists and explorers and scientists figured out that the actual origins of the source of the Nile comes from over 3,000, about 3,500 miles to the south up in the rainforest of Rwanda. That's where the source of it is, and as it you know, Lake Victoria and all that area is kind of the same water source, and it just, of course, it always rains in the rainforest. They would have their heavy duty rain time, and then their not so heavy duty rain time, and then their heavy duty rain time again, and twice a year the Nile would flood like clockwork. It would flood, and so they would take when the Nile would flood, it would of course bring all this silt that would flow down from the rainforest, and then when the waters receded, when the flood banks of the Nile receded, they would leave behind this tremendous, rich, nutritious silt. And they would use irrigation to take that water into their farmlands. And they didn't know you looked in the Egyptian dictionary, there was no word famine in it. They didn't know what this was all about. They'd never experienced anything like this before. Yet God was predicting this to happen, and he convinced, Joseph convinced Pharaoh to get ready. And so verse 37 says, the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. So Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a man as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? I like this. You know, he's brought in all of his magicians, all of his wise guys, all of his spiritual gurus, and he's asked them for an opinion and all this, and they were just kind of like, I got nothing. And then he brings in Joseph, and he immediately, no problem, God can take care of this, and he gives him all of this wise counsel, and Pharaoh's saying, well, that's right on the money. And then he's saying, who could we get to oversee all of this? Now, how many of you know the name Arnold Horshack? Okay, from Welcome Back, Carter. Okay, yeah, Horshack. And he was always, every time Carter would ask a question, he was all about like, me, pick me, and we could picture Joseph behind all of, you know, he's standing there with all of this court regalia, and he's going, Pharaoh, pick me, I'm here, me. No, it wasn't that way at all. I mean, maybe I would do it that way, but Joseph didn't. He was just standing there. He just chill. And so Pharaoh said to Joseph, well, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there's no one as discerning and as wise as you. You know, so he's you know, thinking it through, and he goes, well, you're the only one's giving me any answers today. So you, he says in verse 40, I mean, I know we know the story, but don't let your familiarity with the story not freak you out with this, because this is awesome. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. And only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all of the land of Egypt, which arguably was the most powerful nation on earth at that time. So that was quite a position. And Pharaoh took his signet ring off his own hand, and he put it in Joseph's hand. And he clothed him with garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. Now, don't think he had this like Snoop Dogg thing going on. You know, it wasn't that. It was that big, that Yul Brynner thing. You know, I mean, it went from shoulder to shoulder. You know, if you're from the 60s, it was like T-Rex. You know, it was that kind of a necklace. And he said, and he let him ride in the second chariot, which he had, which was dubbed Chariot Force 2. You know, like you got Air Force One and you got Air Force Two for the Veep. Well, that's, he had Chariot Force Two. And they cried out before him, bow the knee. Minutes earlier, this guy had been the lowest slave in all the earth, and now he's riding around in this chariot where runners are running in front of him saying, bow the knee before Joseph. Bow the knee before Joseph. And so they set him over all the land of Egypt. What do you think was going on in Joseph's mind right now? I mean, every time he would work his way to the top, he would be faithful and he would do what was right, and he was honest and he was fair and he was hardworking, and he would come to the top, and every time he did, he'd get knocked back down. And then he would work his way up to the top again and he'd get knocked back down. And every time he got knocked down, it was like he got knocked down further than the time before. I mean, very likely Joseph was thinking, he wasn't waiting for the other shoe to drop. He was waiting for the other hammer to come down. And it never did. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. You know, as I shared earlier, as we began looking at Joseph, that there have been some, a lot of the Bible guys have counted over 100 ways in which Joseph is a parallel to Jesus. You know, he's a type or foreshadowing of Jesus. And we saw last week about the only way that he wasn't a type of Jesus is when it said that he was good-looking and pretty ripped, where Isaiah says that Jesus wasn't that way. And to understand this, I think to understand exactly what's going on here, we need to look at Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 8. And if you're familiar with the passage, you can just kind of follow along with the screen up here. But if you're not familiar with the passage, if you're not familiar with it, look it up in your Bible and follow along with me here in Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 to 8. If you're not familiar with it, or if you're just too lazy to turn your own Bible, I'm going to show you from it's a very rare but a very extremely accurate translation of the Bible known as the Merriam-Webster Standard Version. And it reads like this. This is my paraphrase. Think about this. This is Philippians 2, starting with verse 5. Think about this the same way Jesus did. Even though he was God himself, he didn't think the rights and the privileges of God were something he had to hold on to. In fact, he completely emptied himself of those rights as he entered this world in the lowest stature of humanity, that of a servant who is bound to his master for life. And as a man without rights, he obeyed his master's will without question, even to die in the most shameful, painful, excruciating way possible, to be crucified. And Joseph is a type of the bondservant. He is a type that he just fulfills Jesus so well in this, or prefigures Jesus so well in this, that in every turn, He's not putting his own interests first. He's setting his own interests aside and thinking of the interest of others. He is the epitome, I think, of dying to self. And it says in verse 45, and Pharaoh called Joseph's name Japhnath-Paaneah. He had a hard time saying Joe. So he called him Japhnath-Paaneah. You know, he would go, okay, Joe. Zoe, or show, or do. I mean, he tried, and it didn't never, so he says, I give up, you know. Japhnath-Paaneah, which his name, the name means in Egyptian. It's actually kind of a descriptive name. It means one who discovers hidden things, or it could also mean the treasury of the golden rest. And so he gave Joseph a name. Now, Joseph, he never goes by it. I mean, he always signed his checks Joseph, you know. He never did go by the name, but that's the name that Pharaoh gave him. And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On. Now, you know, some people say, you know, this is an example. He's marrying this pagan wife, and this is contrary to the Bible. Well, you know, this is 500 years before the law, and 2,000 years before Paul wrote 2 Corinthians chapter 6. So, you know, just Pharaoh says, here's your wife. And you know, again, 5 minutes earlier, he was a slave in the dungeons of Egypt. And now Pharaoh is wanting to give him a woman of royalty as his wife. This is quite an honor. I mean, this was an offer he couldn't refuse, kind of a thing. And so Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt, and he was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now, he was 17 when he left Egypt. I mean, I'm sorry, left Israel, left the land of Canaan. He was 17 years old then, and he's 30 years now. And so, you know, just 14 years later, same age as Jesus was when he began his ministry, by the way, 30 years old. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. And now, in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years that were, which were in the land of Egypt, and he laid up all the food in the cities, and he laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. And Joseph gathered very much grain, as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. They didn't have numbers to go big enough. And so they went from gazillion to just gobs after that. And so to Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore to him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has, and then he says, this is giving the meaning why he chose this name, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. Now, he's not saying that he forget it like he doesn't remember his family. That's not that. He's forgetting it as though he's choosing not to let the pain and the suffering from his family be relevant. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in my land, in the land of my affliction. The name Manasseh means forgetful, and the name Ephraim means fruitful. And I like what J. Vernon McGee, as he says, in other words, he changed his name's sons were Amnesia and Ambrosia, which is kind of cool. Then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. So all the Egyptians were going, oh, this is what famine is. So in order to bring this famine about in Egypt, he had to stop the rain in the rainforest in Rwanda. Pretty cool trick, but to God it was nothing. And so famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished and the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, well, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. I was reading some stuff online today about some attempts to try to show that at this time period, there was a worldwide famine, just as it says here in my New King James. But the time frames didn't quite jive enough for me to really accept that. But if we look at the word that's translated earth over all the face of the earth, the word there is eretz, and it's used over 2,500 times in the Old Testament. Very common word. But 1,540, this is in the King James, but 1,543 times it's translated country. And another 140, it's translated land. And then there's 712 times when it's translated earth, and then just a handful where it's kind of used by other words. So, the word is overwhelmingly, when it's translated in to English, it's translated by the word land or country. The famine was over all the face of the land. NIV says, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. That's clicker getting ahead of me again, isn't it? The NIV says the famine was severe throughout all of Egypt. That's probably a little too narrow of an interpretation, because it was beyond Egypt, even in the land of Canaan. So the NLT, I think, is pretty good here. It says, so with severe famine everywhere, all of the area of that portion of the world, at least. Maybe it was worldwide, but I don't know that the text necessarily, that's the only way to interpret the text. And it says, so all the countries came to Egypt, or came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all the lands. And when Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, what are you doing looking at one another? Indeed, I have heard that there's grain in Egypt, so go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die. So, they didn't have anything to do, because their crops were all failing and their animals were all dying, so they were just sitting around looking at each other. And Jacob says, he's an old guy now, he can't do anything, but he says to his sons, because his sons are like in their 50s and 60s at this point. They're not young anymore either, but he says, go down to Egypt and buy me some grain. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob didn't send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. Remember, Rachel had two sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And those were the only two sons that came from Rachel. And so they were, Joseph was his favorite first, but then when he presumably died, his favor went to Benjamin. And all the sons of Egypt went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was governor over all the land, and it was that he sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. The word bowed down is the word shakah, and it's the same word that was used back in chapter 37, where Joseph was talking about having this dream. He says, hey, brothers, guess what? I had this dream. And there were these 11 shocks of wheat, and the 11 sheaves of wheat, and they all bowed down and before me. And, of course, they immediately interpreted it as he was saying that they would bow down. Joseph had this dream about all these sheaves of wheat. And as he looked at his brothers there coming to him, with their hat in their hands, wanting to buy some grain from him, they probably looked very much like wheat as they bowed before him in the fulfillment of that dream. And it says in verse 7 that Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And then he said to them, where'd you come from? Remember, he was 17 when he left. He's at least 37 now. He was 30 when it started, and it's 7 years later when the famine began. So he's in his late 30s by this time, and he speaks Egyptian. He's got the whole Yul Brynner thing going on. They still, look like Hebrews. He doesn't anymore. And so they don't recognize him. And so he plays on that, and he's speaking in Egyptian to them and speaking kind of roughly. And it says, so Joseph recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. And then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them, and said to them, you are spies, and you have come to the land to see the nakedness. You've come here to see the nakedness of the land. Now, I don't think he was really kind of like getting back at them, Boy, I'm going to have fun with you. It wasn't that at all. What he was doing was testing their sincerity, and he was wanting to see how, is there any fruit worthy of repentance here that they are bringing? And so he said, you guys are just spies. And they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. And we are all one man's sons. And we are honest men. Your servants are not spies. But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And he said, no, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. In fact, the youngest is with our fathers today. And then one, is no more. Now, Benjamin was only about 3 years old when Joseph was sold, so Benjamin wouldn't have any recollection of him. And he's saying, you know, there are 12 of us all together. One of them is just still a young guy, and he's staying with her dad. But then there's another one who died and passed away. But there were 12 of us all together. And Joseph said to them, "It's as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. And in this manner you shall be tested by the life of Pharaoh." So that's a pretty big "by the life of" when you say it, "by the life of Pharaoh." And he says, "You shall not leave this place unless your younger brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you. Or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you're spies." And so he put them in prison for 3 days. Now, a lot of the Bible guys say that Joseph had been in the pit for 3 days, and so that's why he put them in prison for 3 days. It was kind of 3 days for 3 days. The text doesn't say that, though. It might be a logical conclusion that Joseph was in the pit for 3 days because of the typology that he represents of Jesus being in the grave. And we'll see the number three figures pretty prominently in the whole life of Jesus. So that may be the case, but we don't know for sure. But it says in verse 18 that Joseph said to them the third day, "Do this and live, for I fear God. And if you're an honest man, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry the grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so that your words will be verified and you shall not die." So after 3 days, he says to them, "Look, just leave one of you here. And then the other, that would be nine of you, go back and get the youngest brother and then come back." And so they did so. And they said to one another, "Surely we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." Now, we don't hear that from the text when it happened. We don't hear that Joseph was crying out to them and saying, "Please don't do this to me." But they're saying it here. You know, as they're rehearsing it among themselves, we say, "We heard his cries and we ignored it. We ate hamburgers and french fries instead." Because they were so focused on their own things, they didn't hear the cry of their brother. And I don't know if you ever felt guilty before? Of course you have. You know, we all have. And there's a pretty good reason for that, is because we're all guilty. But one of the things, I felt guilty once, and I noticed that it can be a very, there's two things about guilt. It can be very debilitating. You know, I mean, it can cripple a person. But it can also be very motivating at the same time, right? And the thing about guilt, if it's not handled biblically, not only does it end up affecting your relationship with God, but it also begins to affect your very nature, right? And they'd been stuffing their guilt for 20 years, his brothers had. And so we see Reuben, he's the first one to speak up. And he says to them, "Did I not speak to you saying, do not sin against the boy, and you wouldn't listen?" So he's trying to, you know, blame them. And he says, "Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." But he's accepting responsibility as the firstborn. But they didn't know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. So they're saying all this in front of him. And it says, then he turned himself away from them and wept. You know, he's hearing this conversation between them, and they're expressing their remorse over what they had done. And he had to turn away from them because, you know, it was going to cause his mascara to run, and he didn't want them to see that. And so he steps out of the way while he cries, and then he puts his eye makeup back on again, and he comes back out, and he talked with them. And then he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain and restore every man's money to his sack and give them provisions for the journey. And thus he did for them. And so they loaded their donkeys with grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. And so he said to his brothers, "My money's been restored, and there it is in my sack." And their hearts failed them again, for they were afraid, saying to one another, "What is this that God has done to us?" You know, that's a natural consequence, by the way, of a guilty conscience, to think that God's punishing you. You know, when we're carrying around guilt, we just think, "Oh, God's going to spank me," you know. And it says that then he they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man who is the lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country." It's interesting. They never speak of Joseph by name. He's always the man. I mean, I guess they had as much trouble saying Zaphath Paneah as Pharaoh had saying Joe. But they said to him, "We are honest men. We're not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father in the land of Canaan." So they just repeated to Jacob the same thing that had happened. And the man, the lord of the country, said to us, "By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me, and take food for the famine of your households, and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me, so that I'll know that you're not spies, but you're honest men. And then I'll grant your brother to you, and you may trade in the land." And so it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in a sack. They didn't know that till they got back home. It wasn't just the one. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And, you know, you didn't want to have the number two man in the world mad at you. And so Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me." You know, at this moment, his eyes were so focused on his own pain and his own suffering that he couldn't see things accurately. And it was all about, it's me, 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 me. And so Reuben spoke to his father, saying, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you, and put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. But he, meaning Jacob, said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone." You know, it's like the other 10 weren't his sons, and his other 10 weren't brothers of Joseph and Benjamin. "And if any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you have bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." You know, we're going to close with this, but I want to ask a question. How is it that Joseph always seemed to rise to the top? I mean, every time he would get knocked down, he would not only get back up, but he would get back up higher than he was before he was knocked down. And how is that, that you think he was able to do that? And I think that we're told by Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, verse 16, in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." I'd like to end a little differently this evening, and just go ahead and close in prayer now. But then before we're dismissed, before the actual end of our service, our Bible study, is I'd like for us to watch a short video clip. Okay, so let's go to the Lord. Again, God, we stand in awe of your word, and just what a great relevant passage of scripture. What great lessons that are given to us here. And how, even a cursory look we've had tonight. But God, we thank you. We thank you for the clearness of your word. We thank you that you have made a provision for our guilt, and that if we deal with it at the cross, in the name of your son Jesus, and we lay it down and surrender our hearts, our lives, and our sins to you, that you wipe us clean. And I thank you for the example of Joseph, how he was always, even the very worst that the world would throw at him, able to rise up and shine ever more brightly. That's only by your strength and by your power. And we give you the praise, and we, Lord, pray you'd work the same thing out in our lives as well.